It's Thursday, October 17, 2013. Welcome to Session 5 of the Ontolog mini-series on ontology-based standards. I'm Dr. Gary Berg, across from Spatial Ontology Community Practice, which is called SOCOP, and Session Co-Chair, along with Dr. Tara Aton of Aton Services. This session is entitled Ontology Standards in Geospatial Domains. And first, I want to thank all the participants for joining us today, Ontolog for organizing this, as well as support from SOCOP and others. Slide 2 overviews the session agenda. Following my initial remarks for the session, we are happy to have 4 distinguished speakers involved with key standards across several different parts of the geospatial realm and within the practice of ontology use. Starting with Bermudez from OGC, who will speak on geospatial standards and the semantic web. Then Simon Cox of OGC and Cicero, who will speak on observations and measurements. And a special thanks to Simon, who speaks to us from Australia, where it's about 4 in the morning, I believe. One last minute change, Tara Aton, my co-chair, will present Corey Henson's slides, W3C Semantic Sensor Network. Our final speaker is Thorsten Hammond, soon moving from the University of Toronto to the National Center for Geographic Information in the School of Computing and Information Sciences, University of Maine. His talk is entitled Driving the Next Generation of Spatial Standards, Examples from the Hydro Ontology. Presentations will be followed by open discussion Q&A that will be focused on particular topics maybe or covered or more general things. We hope to have 30 minutes or so for that. In the remaining few slides, I have some introductory remarks, starting with a list of goals. Now, the overall goal of the series is to advance the understanding of how ontologies can improve extant standards in the range of communities, including the geospatial, by providing better standards and groundings, which can result in ontology-based standards. This session builds on work coming out of standards bodies like OGC, along with others, that is enabling progress on standards using ontologies. One goal of the session is to further the dialogue between standards bodies and ontologists. We also hope to build on previous sessions, such as the last one on quantities and units of measure. One connection, for example, is made in Simon's observation and measurements presentation. Slide 4 makes the point, graphically as well as other ways, that there are many technical geospatial standards, such as ISO TC211, the general features model, and there are many types of geospatial objects and many types of spatial data captured. Thorsten will have more to say on this in his last talk. Slide 5 makes the point that ontology is really not new to geographic and geospatial topics. And for example, I mentioned in this slide, over 10 years ago, we had the Smith and Mark Geographical Categories paper, which is one of the top 10 cited articles in geographical and GIS fields. We're still wrestling with many of the problems that were discussed there, like what is a region? As shown in the diagrams below, we have many types of regions. After some time, many geospatial data and web feature services have been standardized with terms, but still lack adequate semantics. Slide 6 concerns itself with the W3C Incubator Group work on geospatial ontologies. That defines 7 categories of geospatial foundational ontology areas, such as toponyms or place names. I've listed the 7 here. We'll actually be hearing about some of these aspects, general feature ontologies, feature types, such as USGS types, and basic spatial relationships, such as GeoSparkle covers. And Luis will cover some of those. The last thing on web service ontology is an example where OGC has done a reasonable amount of work. Slide 7 highlights 3 other efforts. One is the benchmark survey of geospatial ontology landscape done back in around 2007 and published later, which reviewed a lot of spatial conceptualizations, upper-level ontologies, and commercial standards like GML. Several of the ontologies listed and discussed in the trades study have been made available on the SOCOP OOR as part of NSF's funding of the SOCOP Interop project that I'm part of. I note also in passing that SOCOP organizes workshops to help develop geospatial ontologies, and the next one, annual one, is at NSF in November. More information on that is later in the later slide. The second thing I would note is the formalization of GeoSparkle, which will be presented by Luis in his presentation. And third is the USGS work in the national map, converting 8 standard layers into an RDF form. Again, this will be part of Luis's presentation when he discusses the OWS efforts. Slide 8 is a historical slide from a prior Ontolog Summit session in which Bill McCarthy made several points about the tension between the theoretical side of ontology work and community standards communities. The first three I mentioned here, the idea of getting it completely right, the perfect one, versus getting it working the good, and OGC, for example, and the standards part has made it work, but we are trying to introduce ontology to that. The second point being getting successful past the tipping point. Again, OGC and geonames are examples of things that have got things working. And the third point here is the idea of a reality-based model versus a practical, a present practice model. That's sort of a legacy problem, and Thorsten's presentation may touch on this. I'll skip the others for the sake of time here, but they are on the slide. My ninth slide to finish up is a reminder on upcoming events. There will be, of course, other sessions within the series, and two are listed here in terms of financial standards and how ontologies can help with the formal specification of natural language standards coming up later in the year. And two things I want to mention, a plug for SOCOP-sponsored events that are coming up. One is a workshop the end of October, 28th and 29th, in the University of Wisconsin called Workshop on Semantics and Geospatial Architectures, Applications and Implementations. I have a link to that. And the other one is the GeoVocamp that I mentioned before, the SOCOP's annual, which will take place at the NSF facility in November 18th and 19th. And you can go to vocamp.org and see that information on that. And lastly, a few things before starting and before I turn it over to Tara. The bios of speakers are online. There's the screen sharing support that you can get to and download files. There's the in chat room. And of course, we'll be muting things for questions and answers. We'll have star 7 to unmute and star 6 turns the mute back on. With that, I turn it over to Tara.
Okay, thanks, Gary. Our first speaker will be Dr. Luis Bermudez from the Open Geospatial Consortium, known short as the OGC, which is an important standards body for the geospatial domain. And the title of his presentation is Geospatial Standards and the Semantic Web. And Luis, I'll give you a heads up when you have 5 minutes left in your time.
So first of all, Gary and Tara, thank you for the invitation, and thank you everybody for assisting to this session. So I've been in the OGC about for 2.5 years, and before I did a lot of semantic work, so I feel we're the head of the semantics task link at OGC. So a lot of the work that is done within OGC, I present it, and I sometimes lead activities like threads in OGC web services, which I'm going to talk about. So next. So the agenda for today is first give an overview of what is the OGC for those of you that don't know, and why do we need the uniform resource identifiers. Then how do we do management? What is the OGC naming authority? I think the governance of ontologies and identifiers are important. I will talk a little bit about the USPARQL, some of the ontology experiments, and then two thoughts for the future. Next. So first, Open Geospatial Consortium, OGC. We are really a group of volunteers. We basically work under a defined process based on consensus. More than 4,000 users are part of working groups. We have standard working groups and domain working groups. For example, there is a geosemantics domain working group, so they are not creating standards, but they are bringing the requirements. So the people that create standards listen to them, and we advance them. And one of those standards is, for example, USPARQL, which I'm going to talk about. We have about 700 implementing products that you can look in the portal, and we also certify. So we have some tests online that we have, so implementers can go there, pass the test, and then pay license, and then the purchasers of software will know what are the software that have been certified or not. Next. So we have a lot of BC standards are being used in science. Maybe you are familiar with NetCDF, which is a binary encoding used to share binary data, model data, like climate models. KML is an OGC standard that Google brought to OGC. WMS, Web Map Service, is used to publish maps on the web. Sensor Observation Services to publish sensor data and standard under composition. Web Process Service to run process on the web, and so forth. Next. So we do not only produce standards, but we produce a lot of artifacts. So discussion papers, requests, white papers. Next. For example, in 2011, we had about 64 change requests. Next. And inside a standard, sometimes we need to identify, so we do not only need to identify the standard, but also concepts that are inside the standard. Conformance classes, which link to the requirements and tell the folks that are going to do the executable test exactly what is what needs to be tested. And all those things have URIs. We need also to provide URIs for critical concepts, such as coordinate reference systems and units. Next, slide number 8. And in 2012, we had a convention to create URNs. And you can see here, this was submitted to IANA. Next, in slide 9. So it was the RFC 5165. Next, slide 10. And we figured out that sometimes URNs are not very useful because we need somehow to resolve, and the developers wanted to know what was behind the URN, so we went to HTTP URIs. So next, slide 11. So we have now URIs that define those different concepts, artifacts that I was talking about. And for example, in this case, you can see some of the OGC definition types where we not only provide the URI, but also some more information about that resource, such as the label, creative, creator, and maybe what's the member of. Next, slide 12. Let's go next, 13. Next. These are all examples, so slide 14. So we have a vocabulary server. All these terms or concepts are formalized in RDF ESCOS. There's also a SparkQL endpoint, so developers can query those concepts. It's also a simple user interface, and these vocabularies are strongly governed. Sometimes we take vocabularies that live or were originally created outside of DC, and we bring them to ODC. So sometimes we see that similar content can appear in two different places. But we want for ODC to have a URI that we can reuse in our standards. Next, slide 15. So there is, and I'm happy that Simon Cox is here because he's also in charge of helping us maintaining this registry, and is being hosted by Sigrid Sizro, so they maintain the ODC concepts. So this is an example of a concept that is inside WaterML. So it's not only the requirements and classes of the specification, but also some specification provides some concepts that we want also to capture as URIs. So next. Slide 16. Now, so I said before that it was very important that we govern it. So at OGC, there is a technical committee. The technical committee is in charge of voting, for example, for new procedures, new standards. And we create subcommittees. And one of those subcommittees of the TC is the naming authority. And they are in charge of managing this register. They are in charge of coordinating with the OGC staff about where can we publish that registry and the enhancements. And also every standard or every document even that is going to be published by OGC needs to pass through the OGC naming authority. So we check the URIs, we check the makes sense, and that we have all that information in the registry. Next, 17, So the conclusions for these first parties, we are very aware and also very happy that a lot of science data is being published by UGC standards. We are using URIs to identify those OGC resources, standards, and the related resources and concepts inside those standards, because then we can easily create more data around them, create, you know, linked data, and we can provide registries with more information about, for example, what standard was being used, if there is a test or not, if there are concepts related to that standard. And we take very seriously the governing of those resources, and we have the OGC naming authority. Good. So slide number 18. So I'm going here to change topic a little bit. I'm going to give a very brief overview about USPARQL. So this is a standard that was published about a year ago. Next, slide 19. It has a very, very simple model. It says that it's a geospatial object, and it has, there are two types of geospatial object. It's a feature and a geometry. And it says that the feature has a geometry. As you see, it's very simple. And it's available in this link. Next, slide 20. And the idea is that communities can use an ontology and create their own ontology. So for example, here you can see that you can define monument. It's a point of interest, that is a feature, and you have an instance Washington monument that has a very particular geometry that also extends a geometry in this part. So it's really very easy to extend. So slide number 21. And USPARQL defines these very special relationships that sometimes are very important. For example, what Gary was talking about, to see what feature of the relationship between, for example, two regions. So this is very useful to have in the ontology. Next. And here is a reference to an excellent article about how to use USPARQL. Slide number 23. Now, let's talk about some of the activities that we have been doing in OGC. So we have various programs at OGC, the standards program, which manages the working groups, the domain working groups and the standard working groups. We have the compliance program, manages the testing, and we have another program called the interoperability program. And the interoperability program manages test beds, pilots, interoperability experiments, where we test and test and test. This is very fast activity. Sometimes it's a 6-month activity where we bring requirements for several from several sponsors, and we have maybe 50 programs all over around the world advancing ideas and then making change requests to the standards or developing new standards. So next. So for those of you that are not familiar, what is a web feature service? I think it's important to give a little bit of background. So in general, the feature model says that feature is anything that has attributes. For example, a tree. A tree in this case has two attributes, height and location. And we can define those types of features, and we say type equal tree, similar as we define a class, for example, classical tree. And a web feature service allows the public to publish, access, manipulate these kind of features. Next, slide 25. So WFS provides then the rules about how to construct a URL where you can get more information about a type of feature. In this case, is GOPS Governmental Unit CE. So communities can create their own types following WFS and provide that information following GML geographic language. That's good and that's bad. The bad is that, next slide, slide number 26, that the communities can define their own types. So for example, the National Geospatial Agency and the United States Geological Survey, for a very similar type of feature, they define different types of feature, they define different properties, and then that is sometimes to handle. So we think, well, we can do semantic mediation and we can make use of, you know, ontologies and mappings to be able to solve this problem. So slide number 27. So in OWS 8, we had this scenario where we had two different types of users. So if you see the user on the left side, it's a California National Guard we said, well, the user prefers the NGA model and is familiar with the local topographic data store, which follows a GML application profile, right? So they find their own features. And we have another user on the right side, which is a USGS, which follows the USGS model national map. So we were able to demonstrate that if we have different data sources, then we were able to mediate and convert a lot of responses from different WFSs, web feature services, to a one model, either the NGA model or the USGS model. Next slide, number 28. And as you can see here a little bit, the architecture, so let's say part of this was a SparkQL server where we had all the feature types and attributes encoded in ontologies, and we had the mappings among them. And we had the semantic mediation component in the middle that was created by Luciet that was able to mediate and convert one WFS request into different responses. So I think this was very, very, very neat. And I'm showing here a lot of details, but we were also able to convert, for example, styles and symbols. So the feature portrayal survey was able to portray USGS data with NGA styles. Slide number 29. We have another use case in AWS 9, or AWS, remember, just a big test bed that we do every year. So you see web services. And the aviation domain working group and the sponsor said, well, sometimes the pilots are not able to search by the feature types by a web feature service. Can we create something so the pilot can search with using terms from a glossary that they are familiar with? So that's what we did. So we encoded the pilot controller glossary, which is JPAMS, and we encode those terms in an ontology, and then the next slide. And then we were able to map those to XM features. So XM features is a GML application profile. So as you see here, we have a GM point, and then they create in a more better point that has their needed attributes, additional attributes that they want to share in their next. So this is more information, for example, what you can capture in an AXM feature model. Oh, this is from GML, but the pilots are not really familiar with all these terminologies and they don't really want to use it. They just want to find very easy data using the pilot glossary. Pilot's glossary, next. So what we did is we had a web processing service that was able to interact with the SparkQL service. So the SparkQL service had the mappings with the glossary and the web feature service that exposed the data following this AXM model, which, as I said before, is a GML application profile. Next. So here, user interface that shows, well, if I type high-speed taxiway, then I will get the feature type taxiway element. Next. And I think this slide don't have slide number, but we are in the CCI GeoNames demo slide. So this was another use case where we had two, you can see there are the land that says California, and then a gazetteer from all over the world that provided names from Mexico and other places. And there was an incident in Rincon. And the use case, the story, was based on, well, this is an international collaborative situation and we need to share data from two different services. Next. And we were assuming, and this is a real case, that they were using a different semantics, for example, to name these types. So we wanted the user to search for hills, and we wanted a service which we named as semantically rich single point of entry gazetteer that was able to communicate with other gazetteers, but was also aid these terminologies, like, okay, HEALS is healed in NGA and Summit in USGS. So it also communicated with a SparkQL endpoint in order to provide the correct response to the user. Next.
5 minutes left.
Thank you. So in OWS 10, and this is a testbed that is just starting, we want something a little bit different. So we have the NGA gadget here, and we know that for these names that are sometimes controlled by the government, there is other information available in what we call voluntary geographic information or crowdsourced data, such as GeoNames, DBpedia, and that we can get information from those sources and even get geometries for surveilling data OpenStreetMap. So how do we bring those kind of information and link it with the NGA gadget here? So that's what we call work on linked data in AWS 10. So we have not done anything. We are starting, as I said, we should be done by March next year. But those of you that are ODC members and want to observe this activity, send me a note and I will tell you how to do it, get involved in the project. Next, slide 37. Now the future. And the future, I have two ideas. One is UML to OWL. So as Gary said, we have a lot of abstract models and other conceptual models in ISO that OGC uses. This is the feature model. And we want to be able to convert those, for example, ISO or OGC models to OWL. Slide 38. So there was a presentation at the last TC meeting by John Brodeur. Next. And he talked about some of the work that ISO has been doing. So basically, it says that they are developing rules to provide this application intelligence in OWL. They're introducing special operators that will allow for special reasoning and inference, translating of ISO harmonized model from UML to OWL, and also defining some web service ontologies. Slide 40. So what we want, really, if you're familiar with the left side, is an ISO 19115 model and the metadata that you see this model push a button and then you have an ontology. You know, that's the whole idea behind it. Next. So if you want more information, and Jean Bordeaux, this is his information. So it's a working process. They are really setting up the environment in enterprise architect and JavaScript, and they are currently doing testing, correcting, and working on beta version. So contact him if you have you want more information about it. Next. And then the next, what I call a future, is that we really need a more comprehensive ontology. And that's one of the things that we've been talking about in this testbed 10. So we have already done some work in semantics. We have this SparkQL. We have this work that is being done in ISO. So maybe we need to extend somehow what we have in this SparkQL and provide a more comprehensive ontology that allows us to better share use spatial data. The working group is about to form. I've seen some international voices that OGC that maybe that will be happening, but you know, stay tuned. Next. So thank you very much. This is my contact information. If you have further questions, but I think at the end we're going to have time for a good discussion. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Luis. As Gary mentioned in the chat, we will be saving questions to the end of all the presentations. And the next presentation will be given by Dr. Simon Cox, who is with CSIRO, which is Australia's National Science Agency. And the title of his talk is An Explicit OWL Representation of ISO OGC, Observations and Measurements and Comparison with the Semantic Sensor Network Ontology. So, Simon?
Thank you. You're using the PDF version of the slides, are you, Tara, Peter? That means I'll have to...
Yes.
talk through a few things. In the original, I have a bunch of transitions to make some of these more complex slides a bit more comprehensible. So I'm not sure if those are available for download, but people can contact me if they need to get those. Anyway, we'll charge ahead. Thank you very much, Luis, for giving that introduction. Thank you also to Peter, Gary, and Tara for the introductory remarks and so on. I guess I'm just going to comment first, reflecting back on the presentation we just heard from Luis. To a certain extent, it could be argued that these two presentations are a bit backwards. Luis is the professional ontologist. I'm the OGC insider. For a lot longer than Luis, I've been involved with OGC now for 14 years, something like that. But as Luis pointed out, part of my work there has been moving both my own technical interests, but also attempting to move OGC more into the adoption of some of the technologies which are required for the for the more effective use of semantic technologies and ontologies. As Luis pointed out, I chair the naming authority. That's the group that's responsible for making sure that there are no URI clashes, and also that we have a relatively orderly set of patterns for the issuing of URIs for OGC artifacts. This isn't related to the issue, to the assignment of URIs to data sets, but it is related to the assignment of URIs for things which OGC governs. That's standards, namespaces, the definitions, so on. And in the definition space, yes, Luis also pointed out that I maintain that set of SCoS definitions, and we also at CSIRO manage the vocabulary service at the moment. I should also point out that OGC does have a working group on geosemantics, which was founded and really nurtured for many, many years by Josh Lieberman, who may or may not be on the call today. I don't see his name on the list, but I know he was at one stage planning on joining. He is he good? So I these days co-chair that with Josh, and also Linda van den Brink from Geonovum in the Netherlands has just joined us to assist in the management of that working group. I'm also Luis also pointed out that there is this ISO TC211 activity under the heading of ISO 19150-2, which is the use of the OWL in geostandards. I'm on that editing committee, and I also lead the URI activity for that. Anyway,
I did join. This is Josh.
Hi, Josh. Thanks. So today, I, in response to the request from Gary, who I met face to face for the first time last month in Washington, I decided to just focus on one small piece of the puzzle because it's a piece which I know has attracted quite a lot of specialist attention in the sensors and observation space, and that is the work that I've been doing and in fact will present at a workshop in association with the International Semantic Web Conference in Sydney next week, which the title of which you can see on the screen in front of you now. So next slide, please. That'll be proper slide number one, numbered number two. There we go. So the outline is that I'm going to give a little bit of a summary, which gives a bit of an insight into the ISO project on the methodology which we've used to develop or at least convert observations and measurements model into OWL, reflect on a couple of the challenges that we've encountered in that, do essentially a one-to-one comparison of the expressivity of that relative to the SSN ontology. It's not a comprehensive test, but it's just a side-by-side lookup, and some issues that arose when we were analyzing this in terms of the alignment, the O&M alignment versus the SSN alignment with other ontology activities. So next slide, please, which is slide three, which just has a title, Observations and Measurements. Next slide, please. Slide four. Okay, so I'm just going to start out by showing you some UML. This is not usually considered to be an ontology language, but the What I'm showing here is a snippet basically from the ISO standard for observations and measurements, which I was, I was primarily responsible. I was the primary editor for that. And it was developed over a period starting in about 2002 and was finally published in 2011. During that time, we didn't have this model at the beginning, but it was developed out of one of those OWS or a series of those OWS experiments or test beds, which Louise mentioned in the previous talk. The goal of the observations and measurements model was to provide a common terminology that could be used by people describing observations in remote sensing, in situ sensing, and also ex situ sensing. Ex situ sensing being when you take a specimen from the real world and move it into the lab to make observations. And the idea here is that these terminology, feature of interest, procedure, observed property, result, allow you to separate out the geospatial aspects from the other parts of the metadata relating to observations. In fact, the ISO standard is formally version 2 of observations and measurements, version 1 having been an earlier version that was only published through Open Geospatial Consortium. The links to the standards, both the ISO and the OGC version, which has now also published version 2, are available on the Ontolog Wiki. So the key thing here is that an observation is essentially conceived of as an event which uses a procedure to generate a result which describes the value of an observed property, that property being a property of a specified feature of interest. Next slide, please. Alongside, this is slide 5 now, alongside the observations model, there is a sampling feature model, and this is recognized in the, particularly in the natural sciences. In pretty much all sciences, you never make observations. The feature of interest of an observation, the proximate feature of interest, is pretty much never the entire thing which you claim to be providing properties for or estimating the values of properties for, but there's an intermediate feature, for example, a sampling point, a sampling surface, that would be an image or a swath or something like that, which you're using to as representative of the ultimate feature of interest, but provides some intermediate state which is more convenient or more accessible. And that in the natural and environmental sciences in particular, there's some fairly standard strategies for establishing sampling features, in particular the idea about sampling at a point or sampling along a curve or sampling on a surface in order to characterize some other feature, some domain feature. And also this very common example of a specimen, which is something that you take from the feature of interest and take back to the lab to make observations. There's a number of, it turns out that when doing the analysis of a lot of science activities, in fact, it's the sampling feature which is essential to being able to fully characterize the activity that's going on, and particularly the relationships of sampling features one to another. So a specimen is taken from a longer borehole or a traverse, curves and points and surfaces are related to each other, and that's the reason for the association class in the upper left there. So this is just basically to say there's been a lot of work spent or a lot of thinking refining the model for both observations and sampling features down to this level over a number of years, which was sort of crystallized in the publication of this ISO standard in 2011. I'll show little snippets of UML after this, but now I'm going to move into the more familiar sort of ontology space. So if you'll go to the next slide, please, slide 6. Briefly just show really just by a side-by-side thing some of the conversion rules coming from 101.50. Next slide, please, which I think will be slide 7. Okay, this all rolls out much nicer if you look at the PowerPoint rather than the PDF, but we'll work with this. The mappings from the UML artifacts into OWL and RDF artifacts are as expected, that a UML package is mapped to an OWL ontology. and a class is to classes, attributes and associations to properties. One area where UML has a feature which is not accessible.
We lost your voice, Simon. Is feedback? Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm very sorry about that. I had a drop out of my internet.
had to give it a good kick, and I think we're back again now. Do you want me to continue?
Yeah. It starts from slide number 7.
So the slide title says ISO 19150-2.
Yeah, okay.
2015 question mark. We need to move on from this. Obviously, we've lost a bit of time now. I'm sorry about that. So, slide 8, please. Okay, there we go. All right. So, I've got a few diagrams in the rest of this presentation where I'm basically, I don't know whether this proves anything, and all of this stuff is online, by the way. The links are given in the references on the wiki. I probably should give direct links as well on the wiki. But these are diagrams taken from Top Braid's diagram view. I know a lot of you are probably using a Protégé users, but I use Top Braid, and this basically just to confirm that yes, observations are successfully managed as alt classes, as subclasses of a class here shown as GF any feature, and this is really a reflection of the fact that because O&M sits inside the ISO framework, it actually makes use of a bunch of other classes in the UML space, which have also had to be implemented in the AL space in order to accurately reflect the observations and measurements ontology or model as it is as it was originally modeled with the dependencies which flow from the context in the ISO in the ISO world. So next slide, please, slide 9. Of course, when you're converting from UML to AL, you have to deal with the fact that there are some mismatches in the metamodel or the meta-metamodel. Particular ones which concern us are that UML is a frame-based modeling formalization where the attributes and association roles are owned by the classes, whereas in the RDF and AL world, properties are scoped to an ontology. Usually this is indicated by them sharing a common namespace. In the RDF world, we expect properties to be reused on different classes, whereas in the UML world, an attribute or an association role may only be used in the context of instances of a particular class. Property redefinition is not so easy in UML, but is very easy and expected in RDF. Next slide, please. Slide 10. So there's a few options for achieving this. I'm showing some examples here using turtle syntax. The same property, which is result time, which was one of those properties shown on the original UML classes, if we're attempting a kind of a strict UML approach where it's scoped to the class, then you would see both this might be reflected in both the name of a property, and here we've used a kind of dotty syntax, observation dot result time, to say that it's only associated with that class, and also fix the domain very tightly as OM observation. Whereas if you're using a more open world approach, which is more consistent with the sort of community norms in the certainly in the RDF and AL space, perhaps in ontologies more general, then it would be scoped generically, or at least only to the namespace or ontology. Here, the OM colon indicates that, and the domain is much more general. So result time could be reused as a property of any feature, not any anything, but in any feature type. And Luis has already pointed out, at least in the GeoSparkle world, and this flows from the general assumptions in the OGC and ISO space, is that geometries are not features and features are not geometries. And so there's some other disjoint relationships which need to be asserted around the definition of the class of features. results. Next slide, please. Slide 11. So here's a more complete example, which you can review at your leisure. I'm showing a little piece from the sampling feature part of the ontology. One thing which I'm just drawing attention to here, I wasn't quite sure whether this was kosher, but the where we see in the original UML model that there are attributes of classes which have got a cardinality of optional to some number, there is a way in which you can express this using the RDF representation of OWL by putting a min cardinality 0, but of course this is not really usually expected in the OWL world because the default cardinality of properties on features is 0. But for the cases where you just want to, I mean, for one thing it made it easier to generate diagrams that look right, but I'm not sure whether there are any dangers in setting a min explicit min cardinality of 0. Next slide, please. This is down in the weeds, I guess. As I mentioned before, an important aspect of observations and measurements is that because it's been developed in the context of ISO TC211, it is thoroughly integrated into a framework of other standards from ISO. The list of which is of direct dependencies is shown down the right-hand side of this slide here, and these are implemented as package imports. As ontology imports. They're package imports in UML. They're ontology imports in the OWL representation. So everything here, the attempt is to say we're reproducing in OWL exactly the dependencies and exactly the models as they are. As they were originally modeled in the UML. And so the idea here was to minimize any additional assumptions or cognitive bias, I think Josh described it as, being brought in from any other space. Stick with the cognitive bias that we inherit from being part of the ISO framework in the first place. Recognize there is a bias there, but that's the one that was used for the design. Next slide, please.
Simon, we can give you about 5 more minutes.
Okay, I'm moving towards the end here. So this is the one which is going to suffer most from the fact that you aren't looking at the transitions, because the bit that's hidden under the left there was where I emphasized the fact that features are not geometries. Geometries are not features. Features have geometry properties. And the one in the middle there, I was gradually building up the actual location of observations and sampling features in the context of the feature model. So sampling features, observations, processes, not sampling features are all subclasses of any feature, and the relationship measurements, geometry observations, coverage observations are subclasses of observation, and the other ones you can see there. Next slide, please. Slide 14. Reflecting back on the presentations we had last week from Ralph Hodgson on QUDT, we are now integrating QUDT and our extensions of QUDT we're able to use those very easily in the context of having an OWL and RDF representation of the observation model. So one of the important properties of the observation class is that observation instances say what property is being observed, and that means you need to be able to have a vocabulary of properties, and we use QUDT for that. Next slide, please. Slide 15. So the final thing I wanted to discuss was just a comparison with what was done in SSN. Next slide, please. I was peripherally involved with SSN, and I know that observations and measurements was used as one of the inputs to the SSN ontology. Unfortunately, it was version 1 of observations and measurements, and there were some clarifications that happened in version 2 that may have led to some slightly different decisions. First thing here is just saying, well, if we take one of the test examples from the observations and measurements standard, we find that we can represent them in RDF. This is Turtle. Using the observations measurements ontology just as easily, or they're equally expressive, although there's a little complication around a property in O&M called parameter. Next slide, please. As I mentioned before, a very important part of O&M is the sampling feature model. However, that was skipped in the SSN implementation. We have implemented that in the OM ontology. Next slide, please. So here's, I already indicated that there's classes for specimen sampling feature and so on, implemented in the OM ontology. Next slide, please. So in the alignment part, which is the interesting thing, let's move on to the next slide, please. It's running. I suppose what I was going to say in that previous one is the SSN ontology actually has a lot more relationships. That leads to some decisions having to be made about how you implement certain bits of observation metadata in an instance. This is the slide about the alignment. Basically I'm highlighting on the left the way that the SSN ontology aligns with Dolce Ultralight. And a decision was made there to put observation as a kind of social object, and specifically as a subclass of situation. This was a bit of a surprise to me when I first saw this, as I had always conceived of the observation class as we'd modeled it in the ISO OGC world as being a kind of event. And that's shown on the right-hand side by the fact, in particular, an observation is considered complete when there is a result time, when you can say what time the result became available, and that kind of seems to imply the eventness. It seems that in the SSN work, they were somewhat confused by, in version 1 of ONM, this other property phenomenon time was called sampling time, and that highlighted the kind of sampling nature of it. In version 2 of observations and measurements ontology, we did some clarifications there, pushed off the notion of sampling into the sampling features, and introduced a different property in ONM observation, which basically says this is the time at which this property value would be assigned to the feature of interest. And so we're a bit clearer in version 2 of ONM that an observation really is more of an event, although I can understand the thinking behind making it a social object as it was done in the dull alignment. Next slide, please. So the idea here, and really this is the rationale for this work at all, is rather than what happened in the SSN ontology, where there was a simultaneous syntactic and semantic alignment, if you like, the conversion from or the interpretation of a UML model into OWL and RDF and the alignment with Dolce all in one step. The idea with the doing the UML to OWL rather more sort of nakedly first would then allow semantic alignment to be expressed in the form of separate graphs with subclass of equivalent class subproperty of relationships to do the semantic alignment as a distinct step and therefore keep the whole thing a little bit less muddy. Next slide, please. I think we're coming towards the end. Yep. So just my summary slide. Next slide, please. We've used a rule set to transform from UML to OWL. We're thoroughly representing the dependencies on other ISO 19100 models, and so we've got OWL ontologies for all of those as well. In terms of the original goals of ONM, the SSN and ONM are got comparable expressivity, but there is this alignment issue, and I guess the assertion is that it might be more appropriate to separate the syntactic and semantic alignment steps into separate steps. And the next slide here is just giving some additional credits. I've now corrected, it's not Fowler and O'Day, it's Fowler and O'Dell. Influenced me strongly at the beginning. There's the TC211 work and some of my colleagues at CSIRO, Rob Atkinson, Rob Woodcock, David Radcliffe, Mark Compton, Laurent Lafour, and Jonathan Yu, and sponsored through a whole bunch of projects. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Simon. Well, that's a great segue into the next talk, which was we had hoped to have Corey Henson, one of the co-authors of the W3C Semantic Sensor Networks report, present, but he was unable to attend due to a scheduling conflict. So I will be attempting to present his slides. I was not a member of that committee, so I'll just be using a subset of Corey's slide deck and explaining it to the best of my ability based on a couple of days, the last 2 days spent reading their report. The focus of the semantic sensor network is overlapping but not identical with the observation and measurement ontology that was just presented. So the main objective of that group was, quote, to develop an ontology to describe sensors and sensor networks. And the ontology that was envisioned there is domain independent and in some sense comprehensive over various perspectives, including a sensor-focused perspective, an observation-focused perspective, and a system-focused perspective. It's intended to be used in conjunction with domain-specific ontologies, enabling the SSN ontology to remain domain-independent, as well as to rely on external ontologies for measurement time, location, and mobility. It's aligned with Dolce Ultralight upper ontology, and it's also backward compatible with the OGC's sensor web enablement standard. Now the second slide shows just a graphic of various sensors, and what's shown here mostly are mechanical sensors, but in reality the concepts that are developed in the ontology are much broader than this notion of mechanical sensors. It includes both biological sensors, such as people going out and making observations with their own senses, and it also includes what might be called computational observations, where you input some data and then use a simulation model to make a predictive simulation, and so that would be an observation of a future event based on certain scenario assumptions. So this ontology is quite broad, quite a bit broader than what you might expect would be needed in this geospatial domain with distributed mechanical sensors. So on slide three, this broad scope, I believe, is critical to dealing with the large volumes of disparate data, and also the multifaceted uncertainty you get with data, including aspects such as noise and ambiguity. In spite of our ever-accelerating pace of collecting such data, we still, in general, have to synthesize data from multiple sources through computational models to get something that is of use, for example, decision analysis. So it's very helpful to have this kind of core ontology that these disparate data sets can be linked to. Now, slide four, the SSN ontology development was initiated with a thorough review of existing ontologies, including the version one of O&M, the observation measurement ontology, but also quite a few more. And as the key concept, the group adopted a stimulus-centric conceptual model, which is shown graphically in this slide. I think this points out not so much an understanding or a misunderstanding of the notion of observation as an intentional choice of a different meaning for the word observation, where what you have here is that a sensing event.
We just lost Tara.
Okay, I had called in back in with my landline.
You're on slide four, so maybe you start from the beginning of slide four.
Okay. All right. So I don't quite know where you stopped hearing me, but at one point I was trying to make the point that observation in the SS Anthology is a situation that holds after the sensor produces its output result. So it exists for all time as a situation after that time, and that allows it to have some existence at later times when it can serve as a stimulus for simulation observations. So I think that's a key feature of the SSN ontology and not a misunderstanding. It's just a different concept of observation, and unfortunately using the same English word for a different concept of observation that's used in the observation and measurement ontology. So going on to slide 5, this shows an approximation to the modular system of the SSN ontology, where there are the key block in the middle where you see the picture of the ear and so on is the skeleton module. And there are also kind of satellite modules involving things such as measuring capability, operating restrictions, and so on. The SSN ontology, I collected a few statistics on that. It has a total of 16 modules, 51 classes, 56 properties. However, the published ontology, which we gave you a URI for, this the OWL document, three of those modules are imported from Dolce, Creative Commons, and I believe OWL Time. So the what's in the SSN namespace is actually a little bit smaller with just 41 classes and 37 properties. And I just want to note, to avoid confusion, at the discussion later on, there's a slight discrepancy between this slide number 5, the diagram here, and the actual modularization. There are some missing modules for measuring and observation and energy. So this is an approximate modularization picture here. Now, if we go to slide 6, we see a little bit more details of what's inside these modules. This, again, is just a subset. Not all the classes and properties are shown here, just some of the key points. And I'd like to just quickly go through a description of this based on somewhat of a sensor-centric perspective. If you begin in the skeleton module, you'll see a sensing device, which is a device that is also a sensor. Following some of the property lines, a sensor observes one or more properties belonging to features of interest. And I'd like to point out another possible source of confusion. The word feature is used twice in these various ontologies. Once to represent an information object, but when we say feature of interest, we're talking about some aspect of a physical entity out in the world. So there's a possibility of confusion there as well with the overloading of the word feature. But as far as the ontologies go, they separate that out precisely. When the timeline goes, sensors detect input, they implement a sensing process, and then they produce output. The output has observation values, and this is where a connection to Dolce occurs through the observation values, which are themselves a region in Dolce, a region of a quality space. And as I mentioned before, an observation is the situation that holds following the production of sensor output. Sensors have measurement capabilities, which are themselves collections of measurement properties. The measurement properties are not shown in this slide, but some typical ones are accuracy, precision, and range. And a sensor doesn't have just one measurement capabilities. It has multiple measurement capabilities depending on the conditions in which it's operating. And so this measurement capability is a reification to allow you to group those essentially n tuples of things like accuracy, precision, range, and conditions. So you can have multiple such measurement capabilities. It's the sort of thing that you have to do in the binary relations of OWL because you can't have n-adic relations. Now, sensors are systems, and they are in general also subsystems of more complex systems that are deployed on some platform. And systems have an operating range, and that can be used to judge the acceptability of sensor output based on the conditions that the sensor experiences at the time of sensing. And systems also have a survival range, which can be used to judge the acceptability of sensor output based on the conditions which the sensor experiences prior to the time of sensing event. So at some time in the past, if the sensor experienced some conditions outside its survival range, then typically you would want to ignore or throw away all the data that is collected after that point because it's unreliable. Now, the report contains a diagram showing the alignment of top-level classes with Dolce, but that was not in the slide deck. So I just wanted to quickly insert in the chat, maybe I'll do that after I finish talking here, a summary of that alignment for the just for your own information. And now let's look at slide 7. This shows a usage of the SSN ontology within the framework of SWE. And so SWE is a data model. It's not an ontology as far as I understand, but it can be semantically annotated with XLink attributes which take on URIs for concepts within the SN ontology. So you have something that starts off as just a data model, but you can add semantic annotations to it using the SSN ontology. Slide 8 shows some use cases, and here these use cases are described based on the ontology modules that would be principally used in those use cases. So the one that's circled there, the sensor device selection and discovery use case, would be less concerned with individual pieces of data or quantities of units and more concerned with the actual attributes of the sensor. And that's shown by the modules that are adjacent and overlapping that use case. And there are four such use cases there, essentially showing different perspectives from which the SSN ontology could be valuable, different parts of it could be valuable. And then slide 9, conclusion slide, looking to the future, there will be this what might be called electronic skin from the large number of sensors of various types which are creating this data, and stitching that skin together is a major task, and there is some hope that this SSN ontology could play a role in helping that pull that together. Okay, I'll finish there. Let's continue on with Thorsten. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, so I will try to be brief, that we have some time for questions at the end. And first, thanks to Tara and Gary for giving me the chance to present my view here. This is a little bit looking into the future, like how we can bring more semantics into standards, into geospatial standards in particular, by using formal ontologies. The examples that I will be using are from some recent work on hydro ontology together with Bojan Broderich of the Geological Survey of Canada. So slide one, why BARS are standardizing geospatial terms? Well, they're first of all the basis for data and information integration, as we probably all agree on, and it supports as a discipline. It's not just the earth science, but much of the data around has some spatial component, so we want to support, like formalize that the spatial information or the spatial aspect of the information and integrate that. But more importantly, there are a lot of different conceptualizations of space and various concepts and relations that we all have some intuition about, such as a boundary, a curve, or a region, but that differ when you look closely in how we would formalize them. So, like a region may be closed, maybe a region on a surface, or some, like a mathematician may think of a region, like a plane as a region. So there are like various differences that we need to account for when we want to integrate data. And the same applies to relations. There are so many different ways to think of containment, for example, like a body being contained in another body or a region being contained in a region, etc. So slide two, the role of our standard is twofold in that sense. We want to provide a reference for the terms, but also define what these standardized terms really mean, define it in a formal way if we can. So expressive formal ontology can help achieve that. The terminology would just be the concepts and relations in the logical language, whereas the semantic, the standardized semantics, can be expressed by the axioms that constrain the interpretation of the terms. So if we think of ontologies, we have the wide spectrum of different ontological languages, and we can think of them as being either heavy or light, analogous to reference manuals or user guides. So reference ontology should be heavy to standardize this, not just the term but also the meaning, where the implementation guide is usually light. So slide three, the current geospatial standards are more on the light side. They usually use UML, RDF schema, or lightweight OWL, as we've just seen in the previous presentations. And so we standardize the terms, but the meaning of the terms is usually not formalized yet. It's just included in the standard as English definitions. So we're really only at the beginning of exploiting the benefits of ontologies. And even like the ontologies, the standards that are formalized, for example, in OLDL, don't use the full expressiveness of the language yet. Another point that I noticed is that relations are usually kind of treated as second tier citizens. They're not playing the same role as concept in the current ontologies, or they're actually kind of separated into separate ontologies. But I think they're really what ties the concept together. I think the relation describe how the concepts relate to each other, for example, behavior of objects. One of the problems here is that the L language has much less construct to actually express information about relations. So, for example, for concepts, you can say that a set of concepts form the disjoint union of a more general concept. You cannot express it for properties or relations. But on the other side, concepts and relations that are used in a lot of the existing standards, such as GeoSparkle or the simple features, are already formalized in the literature. For example, they use mere topological relations such as containment or overlap. And so we have already formal axiomatizations of them. So we should be able to use them and to improve the standards. So slide 4. So the general idea I see how we can use formal ontologies to improve standards is to take the existing ontologies, the existing standards, like that provide a large set of terminology already, like concepts and relations, and then axiomatize them actually in an expressive logic, determine which are primitive or definable concepts or relations, and constrain or define them. And then in a second step, we can actually extract the concept and relation hierarchies again and use them as kind of an implementation guide. So the extraction can be supported by theorem provers. We can use the formal ontologies to verify the consistency and that the concepts and relations actually make sense. And then we get the lightweight ontology basically for free. So I will show some examples in the next couple of slides. Slide 5. So the goal is really to have multiple consistent representation of a standard in different languages. So we can have a formalized version, for example, in Common Logic that provides the full specification, this axioms and definitions, and then extract an OWL or RDF, a version of it that just include the concept hierarchy, the property hierarchy, or domain and range restrictions. And in the other direction, we can use an existing RDF ontology and try to ground all the terms in a common logic ontology, for example. Next slide. One of the advantages of having this full specification is really to verify the ontologies using automated tools, and that's something that has been lacking so far for the geospatial standards. Slide 6. So in the work with Boyan Broderich, we've looked at formally grounding hydro ontology to talk about different kinds of physical bodies, water bodies, how they relate to each other, and starting actually with a common logic axiomatization on which we do the verification and extract later an OWL version that is an extension of the Dolce ontology. Slide 7, so the key elements that we have been looking at are physical bodies, water bodies, and how physical bodies contain voids, physical voids that are spaces where water bodies can be located, and how physical bodies and water bodies contain matter. Slide 8, we can take an analogy from this simple example. We have a container, the glass, that is made up of glass material. We have a void inside the glass where a water body, like the liquid, is located and the liquid itself would be made up of water matter. Slide 9. In the first part of our work, we looked at physical and water bodies, trying to define water bodies by the voids, by their physical containers, voids where they're located in. So, for example, a lake or a river would be located in a hollow of the ground surface, whereas a water well would be below the ground surface, or an aquifer would be in a subsurface void that's constituted by gaps, little gaps between rock matter. Slide 10. Just to give you some examples how the ontology looks like, we define, for example, a rock body or give some necessary conditions for a water body. The water body is constituted only by water if it has any constituents. So that includes concepts such as a dry lake that doesn't have any water, whereas a rock body must be constituted by some water. So we can actually capture these subtle differences in the formalization. Slide 11. For the classification of different water bodies, we first classified different voids based on whether the host of the void is self-connected or not. So in the top row, we have holes that have a single body host, whereas in the bottom row, we have gaps that are hosted by bodies that contain of multiple pieces. The second classification is based on the void's opening into cavities, tunnels, depression, and then a third classification based on whether the opening is to the outside or to other voids only. And with this additional this refinement of voids, we can now define a specific kind of water bodies. For example, a surface water body is a water body that is in a hollow that is hosted by a hollow in the ground surface, whereas a groundwater body would be a water body that is hosted by a rock body below the ground surface, so it doesn't overlap any external hollow. And so on, for example, at the very bottom, we can define a reservoir as the void space of a rock body. So this would make clear that we consider a reservoir just as the space and not as the water that is contained in there. On the next slide, slide 13, we have the owl version that is extracted. So we extended the Dolce classes dependent place by a subcategory of physical void, and then have specific kinds of void for which we can actually state that, for example, every void is either a cavity, a tunnel, or a hollow, and every void is either a hole or a gap. So we have a fairly strong owl version as well that corresponds to the full formalization. Slide 14, equally we can extend Dolce with hydrogeology concept. For example, water, rock matter, soil are specific kinds of amounts of matter, whereas a rock body or a water body are physical objects and so forth. Slide 15. In the second part of our work, we looked at containment relations, so focusing on relation and disambiguating different kinds of containment. So, for example, the rock body contains a hole, which is different from the rock being inside the hole. And so we have various containment relations here. And again, slide 16, we started with the heavy approach first, like the full axiomatization of the different containment relations using various criteria to classify containment based on the physical dependency between the container and the containee, and whether what kind of container and containee we are considering, whether it's a material or a void. And the resulting leaf relations are then exhaustive pairwise disjoint relations, so subproperties of the general relation containment. So on slide 17, we actually get the taxonomy that we derived from the formal ontology. So every subclass relation is provable, and the disjointness of the sub-relations are provable as well. So we can express this taxonomy in R using subproperty and disjointness relationships, but we cannot express the exhaustiveness. So slide 18 to come to conclude my talk. The two things that I notice here. First, it's critical to ground lightweight implementation representation in a formal reference to disambiguate geospatial concept and to actually have a representation that we can use for automated or semi-automated verification. And once we have the grounding, we can easily extract a lightweight version again if we need it, that we can actually use as an implementation guide. So standards should be flexible in two ways, not only offer kind of extensibility to specific domains, but also offer differently formal representation. So with respect to the first point, slide 19, we want to have various tiers, like a foundational one versus a domain one, and then we can extend them with application-specific concept. And slide 20, that's the second flexibility that we want by offering different degrees of formality. So we can do reasoning and verification on the most formal specification, whereas the least formal specification can be used for implementation, for example, for collecting data in a triple store. So it's trying to bring together what Gary mentioned at the beginning, getting it right and getting it working. So to kind of the most formal side is about getting it right, and the least formal side about getting it working, and we want to bring them together, how we can make them consistent. Next slide, 21. One further observation is that a lot of the work has been on the upper ontologies, which can only be formalized to a certain extent. They're by design fairly general. And what we really need to do is to move to the middle layers that can be formally standardized, where there are not too many concepts, so it's still manageable, but it's really worthwhile because that's where most of the integration happens. And as I mentioned before, relations are often neglected. Is a reason because they're less understood or because the languages don't really support them? We have to look at that a little more closely. Slide 22 is some details. Like if you're interested in the hydroontology rubric, the publications are available, and the formal ontologies are available in Colora, in the Colora repository. under the name Multidim Mute Topology in Multidim Space. So thanks to Boyan, who's been working on this work with me together, and Mike Gruninger, that I discussed some of the ideas, and thanks for your attention.
Okay, we're now in our question and answer period. Peter, do you, I guess we need to advise people to raise their hands and unmute if they have questions to ask of the speakers.
Right. So first of all, people need to be in the chat room to raise their hands. And when you raise your hand, Tara, who's running, moderating the discussion, would recognize you, but we will usually go by the order they are queued in the chat room. And when you're recognized, test your voice first before trying to speak, because if you don't do that, you might be speaking into a vacuum. So please push the hand button now. If you would like to make a remark, ask a question, or whatever. Since we lost a little bit of time getting people reconnected, we could extend the session for another 10 minutes after the half hour.
Okay. Gary has his hand up.
Okay. Hopefully you can hear me. I just wanted to be sure that we had an opportunity for our wonderful speakers, including you, Tara, to have a chance to have a cross discussion. So if anybody, any one of you, has a comment or a question to each other, I want to make sure we include that possibility, okay?
Luis. Go ahead, Luis. Star 7 on your phone.
Bad connections today. So we cannot hear you. Maybe, Luis, you can type it in the chat, possibly. Lots of people having problems with Skype today.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, why don't I mention a few of the questions that have come up in the chat. I had a question during Torsten's presentation concerning the definition of water, whether that includes dissolved substances in water, for example. And we had a little cross discussion regarding that a water body is a more complex thing than just water, but still come back to the question of what exactly is water.
Yes, I didn't go into any details there. So at that level, we think of water as potentially containing some dissolved things, but not containing crocodiles, for example. So it's the matter on a kind of finer grained level, but not pure water, like in the chemical sense.
Okay, so do you draw the line at actual solution?
Well, we actually think of it as several layers of different granularity. So we have an object that's way top, like a water body would be the object, and then that's constituted of water on the next level, and the water again may be constituted of water molecules plus salts plus whatever you can imagine. So one of the current work that we do is about this constituency relation and how to model solution suspensions, etc.
Okay.
So it's not quite done yet.
Thanks. I don't know if there are any other outstanding questions from the chat. Josh.
I'll just mention that we had a little bit of discussion, maybe sparked by a obnoxious comment of mine, but I think there's a lot of actually interesting content in this difference of approach between the O&M and the SSM, having to do with something which is both what is science, what is a scientific observation, meaning particularly both agreement and reproducibility so that an observation can be comparable even if made by two different people in two different situations. Whereas the SSN approach really looks at the processes of observing as being one of reasoning. And there's a lot of support for that in the way particularly that geological observations are made, because it is necessary not only to have a process but a theory in order to do that. So you can see a concern about changing theories affecting how observations are made, informing the SSN approach. So I think there's a lot to be said for looking at what the difference between those two models says about how the world is perceived by people that could be explored. And I'd be interested to pursue that.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Josh. I think that's a really important point. A lot of sensors, some sensors are based on very well accepted theories, and so that transition tends to be forgotten. But there are also many other observations that are based on theories which are still being actively refined. Okay, Harold?
I have a question for all speakers. To what extent did you apply your T-box-like ontology to A-boxes? In other words, to what extent did you instantiate your classes? Did you populate your ontology? Say for some use case where you actually described some geographical area.
Any speaker that wants to chime in?
I could start. We, I guess, part of the hydro ontology, we haven't really populated the ontologies. We more looked at the general structure. So that's still outstanding work to see how it works together with the data.
Simon, do you have a comment on that?
Some limited testing, some of which was shown in the presentation. So that was instances of the observation class in both the SSN and the ONM ontologies shown there. Those were just desk exercises, but there's a lot more examples of the SSN ontology instances. Individuals, if you go to, I guess, the link or follow backwards from the links, which I pasted into the chat window a while back. I'm not sure if that's sufficient answer, however, whether that's addressing your real question.
Okay. Luis, do you have a comment on this as well?
I guess you'll have to type out his answer. We still can't hear him.
Oh, okay. All right. And I can't really comment being just a stand-in on the SSN, but I guess Simon has a better understanding that apparently that has been instantiated somewhat. Okay. Gary?
I sort of had the follow-up to Luis's question for Thorsten, which I think has got a little bit of discussion going on in the chat. How far do you think OGC should go standardizing geospatial ontologies? So Thorsten has started to answer that. My sort of perspective on that is, given Thorsten's point on heavy versus light ontologies, the natural sequence would be create the heavy ontologies, you get the light for free, but yet a lot of the standards bodies sort of are working more on lighter things. So we seem to have a little bit of a problem here. How do we put together people who can do the heavy things with the standards bodies who need and want to have the light things?
Okay, let me try to add to that. I think it not only works in one direction, you can actually use the existing lightweight to start developing the heavy ontologies and then kind of supplement axioms by taking the existing terminology and relating the concepts in more detail. And then at any stage in that process, you can always generate like a light ontology again, that would be kind of the revised version of the original ontology, of the original standard, but at the same time you kind of make progress on getting a more formal version out there. So it's not a one-way process. It can start with the lightweight room first.
Any other speakers want to comment on that?
So, this is Josh. One comment I would make is that there is, I think, an aspect of practicality to decisions about standardization. You know, where is this inability to match concepts really limiting the use of observation, really limiting the ability to find data? And those sticking points are really the places to focus on standardization. The ontological mechanisms we have available kind of minimize the need to standardize over some other technologies, I'd say. But still, there are these important sort of junctions where, you know, unless we really match up concepts and agree to use them uniformly, we're in a lot of trouble. So that would be my sort of practical standard for
Simon again. Yeah, there certainly is a tension here. We're hitting I would say there's something of a crisis going on in the geospatial standards space at the moment, because just at the time when some major institutional adoption of some of the standards which OGC was putting out, you know, maybe 10 years ago, just when that institutional adoption is happening, particularly in Europe through Inspire, we are, some of the limitations of some of those standards are becoming, more and more acutely visible. You know, the reality is that out there in the real world, it takes organizations, particularly government organizations, many years to retool and adopt standards. And so there's a significant time lag between their formulation and some of the OGC standards. Really, the thinking behind them, behind something like WMS, is now more than 15 years old. And yet, WMS is the most successful, of course, OGC standard, but the patterns that were established by WMS that were then adopted by the other OGC standards in WFS and WCS and such like, you know, very much rooted in that kind of model of 15 years ago and only just being widely deployed. And yet we are aware, you know, and Torsten's presentation was the second time in just over a week that we've heard about the limitations of OWL and how common logic is the solution or something like that. And so there is a, you know, I'd say to the academic community or the more research, the more formal community, you do have to have a little patience when dealing with the standards community, because the standards community are trying to balance sort of technical precision and correctness with some pragmatics around the adoption cycles of the institutions that we're actually aiming at. But in this space, I suppose the last little bits of the presentation that I made was sort of giving a little bit of a pointer and saying, look, I wonder if we can have a more gentle and more respectful, if you like, transition route from where the standards organizations are now to where we would like to see the work going if it was done more formally. But if you jump too many steps in one go, you find that the input material, in this case the O&M standard, is almost you can no longer see it very clearly in, for example, the SSN ontology because of the, you know, understandable but, you know, perhaps premature alignment with Dolce in that case, which without doing the intermediate steps. And what I was putting up was the idea that perhaps the intermediate steps are we need to have a map with all of those intermediate steps in place in order to be able to join these communities together.
All right. Thank you, Simon. That's some interesting procedural insight there. I don't see any more hands raised in the chat window, and I think we're approaching like 10 minutes or so over time. So perhaps I should close the session now. Do you think that we should
do that,
Peter? Yes,
indeed.
Okay. I thank the speakers again for their very interesting presentations and a great in-depth view into the contents and the development process behind a lot of these ontologies. I think there's a lot of opportunities for people who are interested in this to become involved, as most of this standard development takes place in the open. And so I would encourage any of the participants today to get involved and contribute. Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you. Great session. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.